Yeah, I'm going to, I suppose, completely unsurprisingly, keep my remarks to very, very few subjects, but completely dominated, of course, by events in the Middle East. So just start off with what everyone knows, but you have to say it. And that's, first of all, the US UK airstrikes on. I'll call it North Yemen because I can't stand the BBC talking about Houthi rebels when they control, the Houthis control the capital and the vast bulk of North Yemen. Either way, we also have US, not UK, attacks in Syria and Iraq. And whereas 36 targets were hit in North Yemen, it was 83 targets in Iraq and Syria. Why Yemen? Well, this is in revenge for attacks on shipping in the Red Sea. Why the attacks in Syria and Iraq? This is in revenge for the killing of three US servicemen in Syria on the border between Syria and Jordan. What are the US forces doing in Syria? Well, this is the result of so-called revolution. This wasn't equivalent, in my view, at least, to what happened in Egypt and in various North African countries, whatever you want to call it. What we had is the extremely quick intervention by Saudi Arabia and other such Gulf states, sort of breakdown of the Syrian state, the rise, amazing rise of Islamic State. But we also had intervention from the United States, and of course, it's not only US troops in Syria. I think there are still something like 800, 900 of them, but there's also the residue of the US occupation force in Iraq. And we're told, I've got no reason to doubt it myself, that the attack which killed the US servicemen and various other attacks have been organized by Islamic forces, specifically the Islamic resistance in Iraq, that is apparently attached, has got a relationship, and I don't doubt that, with the Revolutionary Guards, with the Quds, a force that used to be commanded by Soleimani. But I do think, just like I've been saying with the Houthis in North Yemen, that the idea that we should take it for granted that these forces are mere puppets, or as the BBC would say, mere proxies of Iran. I would suspect myself that things are a little bit more complex. In other words, if we look, for example, at Yemen and the Houthis, you've really got to say that they're clearly not made and manufactured, in Tehran. They clearly have their own historic roots, and they also have their own specific constituency and their own specific political ambitions. And if we look at the axis of resistance, it has to be said that the most effective part of it is from Yemen. And of course, what is being reported, at least by the more objective Western media, is that the Houthis have found themselves incredibly popular throughout the Middle East. I can also report that they're incredibly popular with at least sections of the masses on the streets in London, but also they're incredibly popular in Yemen. I've got no way of judging it, but it's interesting. The FT did some sort of report about a popular TikToker from North Yemen who was praising the Houthis. And in amongst the more popular press in Britain, they were reporting him as a Houthi. Well, you just look at the guy and you go, no, he's not. And indeed, what the Financial Times was reporting is that no, he's not a Houthi. He's someone who's popular, on social media, and he was praising the Houthis. That's the point that we need to understand. So, in the same way that we need to understand the Houthis are not simply acting as pawns of Iran, we also need, I would suspect, to understand that the Islamic resistance in Iraq also has its own constituency, also has its own motives. And amongst the motives there will be the deeply unpopular nature of the continued presence of US forces in the country, in spite of repeated requests from the government in Baghdad for them to leave. Now, of course, we all know that the American invasion, I'll call it an American invasion, that overthrew Saddam Hussein, didn't bring, Western civilization. It was not a repeat of, what happened in Japan or Germany. It fragmented, the country. It brought chaos, to the country. It brought mayhem. And in that sense, you can't really talk any longer about Iraq, other than a piece of geography, because if we look in the north into Kurdistan, which is disputed, there's a I'd call it an autonomous government. If we look around the rest of the country, what we're talking about is fragmentation. And nonetheless, the government in Baghdad has called for America to take its troops out. So, in other words, if we take this Islamic resistance movement taking a potshot at them every once in a while, the idea that that's deeply unpopular, on the streets of Baghdad or Basra or other Iraqi towns and cities, I would suspect that would be false. I suspect myself it would be the opposite. So, in the same way, that the Houthis undoubtedly have gained in popularity throughout the Middle East and in Yemen itself, I suspect that this particular militia and other militias that have been staging attacks on American forces gain popularity as a result of it. Now, I don't know whether Iran can simply switch these things off. I think that would be too crude a reading. But we do know that there is pressure on Iran, not so much from the United States, in terms of its threat that next time we will not attack targets in Iraq or Syria, but next time it will be Iran. That's certainly the agenda of the Trumpites in the United States and many other Republicans. But also there's pressure on Iran from China, and China matters to Iran because, given US sanctions, given the US attempt to put Iran down, it's China which is Iran's, I suspect, biggest strategic asset. Either way, the idea that the US and Britain has that if you bomb them, you'll get them to behave, I think, is founded. If that is the case, if that's what they believe in, is founded on a wrong intelligence estimate. And indeed, as I've tried to argue, it could produce exactly the opposite effect. In other words, the more you bomb them, the actual stronger they get. So it could have, in other words, from an American point of view, unintended consequences. Okay. Wanted to turn to another aspect of the Middle East crisis, and this is specifically related to Gaza, which I'll touch on further on. But this is the joint declaration that's been produced by political appointees and civil servants. I call them civil servants. I use the sort of British lexicon for these purposes, but it includes people from the United States, people from the EU, people from Germany, people from France, people from Britain. And these there's at least 800 of them. This includes, as I said, political appointees as well as civil servants. And basically, the message is that we don't want to be complicit in genocide. We don't want to be complicit in ethnic cleansing. We don't want to be complicit in an alliance with this far right government in Tel Aviv stroke Jerusalem. Now, I'm not saying that this joint declaration is the equivalent that we saw with the Iraq war, where the division in the ruling class went very high. So, for example, in Britain, you take MI6, it clearly wasn't happy with what was going on. And you could go right up into the bureaucracy. And of course, if you take the Labour government at the time, Tony Blair might have been a lapdog, to George Bush. But Cook, his foreign secretary, wasn't happy with it, and indeed did the honourable thing and resigned. So opposition to the Iraq war ran right into the heart of the ruling class and the political class. So I'm not equating it with that, but nonetheless, this is a very important development. To break ranks with the pro-Israel consensus from within inside government, from within inside the bureaucracy, this is important. And in my view, these things matter, just like the judgment, okay, an interim judgment by the ICJ in The Hague. It's interesting, if you look at this week's Socialist Worker, I'm told that the argument by Alex Kalinikos in his column is flawed in terms of equating international law with ideology. But the important point about the article by Alex Kalinikos is he's precisely correcting, although he doesn't openly say so, he's precisely correcting the editorial statement in Socialist Worker from the week before, which said, ha, we don't care about judgments by international courts. What matters is how many people come out on the streets and how many people go on strike. And what Alex Kalinikos correctly was arguing is that symbolism matters and splits in the ruling class and judgments by the International Court of Justice. They can't enforce it. He makes that perfectly clear. That would take them going to the Security Council, and that, of course, would guarantee, at the very least, a US veto and perhaps a British veto. But in terms of its political consequences, what it does, and along with this joint declaration, it delegitimizes Israel's military action. And that is important, and that matters in terms of mass action. And of course, we need to understand that at the end of the day, it's of course not international courts, it's not civil servants expressing their deep discontent, it's not even masses of people coming out on the streets, or for that matter, going on strike. The crucial question that we need to confront is really the question of an alternative government. That's the decisive thing. And of course, that's our dilemma, both in the United States and in Britain. I'm not going to go through every other country. But in terms of Britain, of course, if we look at the Labour Party, which has been running high in opinion polls, and we would expect it to win the next round of by-elections, maybe the opinion polls, deflate in the election campaign. Who knows? But the point would be that nothing, but nothing, separates Rishi Sunak and Sir Keir when it comes to foreign policy, crucially when it comes to the Middle East, crucially when it comes to Israel, crucially when it comes to Gaza. And the same can be said of the Democrats and the Republicans and the Democrats and the Trumpites. And maybe the Trumpites will be even more gung-ho. And it's certainly true. And again, I wouldn't dismiss it as an irrelevance. These things matter. The sanctioning by the Biden administration of four individuals, just four individuals, not in Gaza, not in the Israeli Defense Forces, not in the Israeli War Cabinet, not in the Israeli Coalition Cabinet, but on the West Bank, four individuals have been sanctioned. I actually listened on Radio 4 to a representative of one of the coalition parties in Netanyahu's government, and I just thought how foolish this individual was. She was basically sneering at Joe Biden, and that seems to be the response from the four. I mean, read interviews with them, I think, in The Guardian, and they're just turning around and said, "Well, I've never been in the United States, don't want to go to the United States." But the point that needs to be made, of course, is if there was a switch off button, maybe it wouldn't be an instant one, but the United States can switch down the Israeli military in a very short time. So, not instant, but nonetheless pretty damn quick. So, if we look at Joe Biden, yes, he's sanctioned four individuals who are thugs, by the way. And not only, I say not only, you would expect them to be thuggish, wouldn't you, against the the indigenous Palestinian population. But they are thuggish in terms of Israeli citizens, Israeli Jewish citizens that happen to object to their ethnic cleansing operations, their terrorist operations on the West Bank. And what they do, these individuals, see the court cases against them, you see the accusations against them, they took an iron bar, on the body, on the head of anyone who gets in their way. That's the nature of them. But as I said, they put in an individual, I presume, chosen individual representing these people up on the BBC and crowing with arrogance. But as I said, I think foolishly, because the United States could switch off, and it could switch off supplying, the 2,000-pound bunker busters that have been used. It can switch off the artillery shells that are needed. It can switch off the spare parts that are needed to keep F-16s, F-35s flying. As I understand it, for something like for every hour such aircraft fly in the sky, they need something like 10, 11, 12 hours of maintenance. And that's not just greasing the parts, that's putting new bits and pieces into them, without which they would have to cannibalize other such aircraft. Anyway, my point would be that these splits, while they don't go right to the top, shouldn't be dismissed. Alex Kalinikos is right. Mike McNair, of course, is right in his current article in the Weekly Worker. But as I say, the significance to me of the Kalinikos article is, although it's not stated, it's a corrective to, I presume, Charlie Kimber, the editor of Socialist Worker, in his editorial last last week. So splits at the top matter. And of course, as the Human Rights Watch in the United States has pointed out, and a lot of other observers in the US have pointed out, of course, the sanctioning of these four individuals on the West Bank comes as Biden was visiting Michigan. I don't know enough about Michigan, but I know now that Michigan contains a lot of people who originate, or families who originate in Palestine stroke Arab countries. So there's an electoral consideration undoubtedly there. But meanwhile, of course, in spite of this joint declaration, in spite of the sanctioning of four individuals, the US supplies the bombs, supplies the shells, supplies the spare parts for aircraft, supplies them with missiles, etc., etc., etc. Okay, so I was on the, I think it was the 8th national demonstration called by Stop the War Coalition, Palestine Solidarity, Muslim Association of Britain, CND, and whoever. Socialist Worker reports 200,000. That is considerably down on previous demonstrations. Now, I can't claim to know how many people were on them, other than going, well, I hear what Socialist Worker was saying, and I hear what Stop the War Coalition was saying. And the previous demonstration a few weeks ago was reported at 500,000, and the demonstration before that was 800,000. And I have to confess, while I saw the last demonstration to the very end, that 800,000, I was waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for the end to appear, and I was so damn tired, I gave up. This time, I saw it pass me by from the front when I was just at Whitehall at the bottom end of Trafalgar Square, and I blinked to myself when I saw the end. I'm so used in that sense to huge Palestine demonstrations taking hour after hour after hour after hour to pass me by. I looked around and said, is this the end? And it was the end. I have to say that the figures produced by the freebie, the evening freebie called The Standard, I think it's owned by a Russian now. It produced figures that said that the demonstration was 10,000 to begin with. Well, I know what 10,000 looks like because, you know, that's the sort of size you can almost go up and down the demonstration and count every individual, as opposed to judge things by how many hours it takes to pass you by. Now, it's true, the Standard said that the march grew, and it grew from 10,000 at the beginning to 20,000 as it marched into Whitehall. I think it was a bit bigger. I don't know, but it did take hours. So yes, down. Why down? I do think that there's a sort of, well, we demonstrated last time. We demonstrated the time before. What impact has it made? We're still angry. And it's good that Stop the War Coalition and other comrades are going for things like workplace protests, going for protests by school students and students and staff. That's excellent. And I have to say that that is a good thing to do. It's a good thing to have local demonstrations, local committees. It's a good idea to put pressure on local government, whatever the law says, pass resolutions, do whatever you can. But we come back again to the problem of Stop the War Coalition and other such forces, is that what is completely lacking at the moment is any sort of viable alternative to Keir Starmer. Let alone obviously to Rishi Sunak. Rishi Sunak has got an alternative, and it's called Keir Starmer. Just politically, it is no alternative. And if we look at the Labour Party, well, as I said, it's not just a question that it mirrors the Tories. Look at its internal regime, because we had Kate Osnamore, MP, getting up in Parliament. This is as the bourgeoisie, as the great and the good mark, International Holocaust Memorial Day. And they all make their speeches. And of course, they all have a political edge at the moment. And quite rightly, she gave it a political edge. And she linked, not in a direct sense, but she didn't say that, the mass extermination of Jews between 41 and 45 is exactly what is going on in Gaza. That would be a nonsense. There are no extermination camps. There are no trains, being diverted in order to take people to death camps. No, of course not. But she linked that particular genocide to what happened in Cambodia, where something like, I mean, who knows the exact figure, something like a third of the population was wiped out by the Khmer Rouge government, which then ended up, should never be forgotten, backed by not only China, but by the United States. They retained their UN seat, but also other examples. And she named Rwanda, and I think less convincingly Bosnia. But she mentioned Gaza. And then tragedy. Because there were protests from both the Labour Party and other, she apologized. Why apologize? She apologized because she offended some people. Well, I'm sorry. I mean, what on earth? I mean, can you imagine a situation? I mean, I'm not drawing any direct power, but imagine someone, who was cursing the Nazis, cursing the SS, cursing this death system, and it upset a Nazi. I mean, would you even dream of apologizing? Would you dream of apologizing if you upset someone who is a supporter? I mean, I included the United States and China. If I upset the United States and China because I said you backed the Khmer Rouge against the Vietnamese regime change, I wouldn't give a damn whether I offended you or not. And in fact, I'd be glad that I offended you. So what on earth are you doing apologizing? And we know now, we've known from the beginning, from the very, very, very beginning, you do not apologize to these people. It makes no difference. And what it does, it sets up the next victim. And I remember this, in this online communist forum, I see we have a certain Stan Keeble. And I remember him being done at work by a combination of the BBC and the Labour Party and the Tory Party. And there was a temptation. I remember we debated it. I don't know whether he did it or not. I hope not. He should apologize. He didn't mean to offend anyone. Well, he told the truth. He told the truth about the Nazis and the Zionists in the 1930s. What's the truth? The truth should be told. And if it upsets someone, let them be upset. But of course, what happened to Kate is she's suspended. And what that means in the Labour Party today is that given this is now almost certainly, bah, freaky, freaky something, an election year, she will not be an MP. She will not be a Labour candidate. And that's been made clear. So all of the rest of them, all the rest of the so-called socialist campaign group now are basically under threat. You speak your mind, you come out against the possibility of genocide in Gaza, you protest about ethnic cleansing of what? 2 million people? Is it 2 million plus now? The death of 25,000? You protest about that? You lose your position as an MP. So, what's the use of you, though, as an MP, is under these conditions you keep your mouth shut? What's the use of you? You're completely useless because if you don't in Parliament, express your opposition to this, What it makes you is complicit. You're not going to get killed. It's just your career. Yes, you might lose your, is it £86,000 salary, whatever the damned sum is? You might lose that. That's true. But people are dying, and the possibility is there that the number of the deaths will go up incredibly rapidly. Why they haven't so far, I almost don't understand. But this is clearly a situation of where we're on the cusp of deaths on an unimaginable scale, given that we're only talking about a population in Gaza, what, 2.2, 2.3 million. Already the death toll per capita, per head, per thousand, is higher, than what London or even German cities suffered in World War II. And of course, as I've argued previously, what's happening is that terms are being redefined. The best place, by the way, to see this redefinition that's going on under our noses is to read the Telegraph. I love reading the Telegraph at the moment because every time I read a story about anti-Semitism, I go, this isn't really going to be a story about anti-Semitism. It's a story about what you call anti-Semitism. So I've already quoted previously in a online communist forum, Tabitha Shapps, the daughter, poor young woman up there in Leeds University. Fellow students are saying Israel is an apartheid state. This upsets Tabitha so much. But the Daily Telegraph reports it as anti-Semitism. Well, as I've said, well, that would make Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, various UN reports, Jimmy Carter, and I could go on and on. It would make all of them anti-Semites. And so this week, we have the Telegraph again reporting the demonstration on Saturday. And it said there were anti-Semitic placards. Well, I've already reported to, there I was at the beginning of the demonstration, watching it plow on past at a fair lick into Whitehall. I didn't see any anti-Semitic placards. I didn't hear any anti-Semitic chants, not because people are afraid of the police, which they are, right? But because the demonstrations are not anti-Semitic. And indeed, another characteristic of this demonstration on Saturday, as with the 500,000 demonstration, is the Jewish bloc. And on one of the first demonstrations, our weekly worker sellers actually were told to get together at the Needle on the banks of the River Thames, which was where the Jewish bloc was also a gathering. And are these people met with boos and sneers? And is this? No, they're clapped to the rafters. And of course, it changes people's mentality. People who take it for granted, the Israeli propaganda that Israel is the state of all Jews, this is brought into question. So, of course, there are anti-Semitic instances as a result of Israeli propaganda. You can hear about them in my area, which, as I said previously, is a particularly Jewish area. So, for example, just I haven't seen it in a local paper. Someone was just telling me about it. I would say someone who's a bit mentally disturbed was going around with a knife in up the road in Finchley, asking people who are evidently look like Jews what their view of what's going on in Gaza was. Well, when you're waving about a knife, this wasn't a friendly inquiry, but I don't know. But these things will happen, right? But the more we have, demonstrations such as yesterday with a big militant Jewish bloc, the better. And the more people are on such demonstrations, the more they will overcome backward ideas. And what we have, of course, is a demonstration made up of all sorts of different people. But the overwhelming, characteristic is a mixture of Muslims and secular leftists of one variety or another. And this is clearly politicizing the Muslim population in London, but also in Britain, and I would argue wider afield as well. So anyway, getting back to my Daily Telegraph, right round the circles there, didn't I? Okay, this is quote, this is in Telegraph. This is the placard that they were defining as anti-Semitic. Maybe I'm an anti-Semite. BBC is an arm of the Zionist propaganda machine. I'm sorry, I listen to the BBC. I listen to the news, and I go every time the word Hamas is mentioned. We hear the BBC saying this is defined as a terrorist organization by lots of governments, including the British. No criticism of that, by the way. What we have is Houthi rebels. What we have is a discourse that is totally depicting Israel as the victim. What we have, is grieving Israelis. And I know the BBC, of course, will be under constraints. So who wants to send journalists into Gaza at the present time? But there should be no excuse for the BBC's supposed even-handedness, because it isn't actually even-handed. It doesn't question Israel's right to exist as a Zionist state. It doesn't question at all this whole witch hunt in the Labour Party. Indeed, as I've indicated, it was the BBC, along with Tory and Labour, and not just right-wing Labour, but mainstream Labour politicians, who were responsible for witch hunting Stan Keble, and have been responsible for the witch hunt directed at the Corbyn leadership, but with thousands of Labour Party victims, to the point where we get the previous Home Secretary denouncing one of the biggest marches in British history as a hate march. And I presume it's the hate march because it hates Jews. This is a big lie. And that is something that the BBC, if it was anything to do remotely with honest journalism, would be exposing. But no, the BBC is complicit in this. Who can forget that dreadful panorama program, that was just full of nonsense about the Labour Party, containing, anti-Semites around every corner. Anyway, moving on. Just wanted to look very briefly at the military situation, because Israel announced at the beginning of its, I'll call it special military operation on Gaza, its ethnic cleansing of Gaza, that it would begin in the north and it would move south. And it told people leave Gaza City. And they went to Khan Yunis. And now it's telling people to leave Khan Yunis because Israel is saying, we're now going to be doing the ground operation. We're now going to get rid of Hamas. What it means by getting rid of Hamas is getting rid of the Palestinian people. That's what it meant in Gaza City. That's what it means in Khan Yunis. And stage three of this military operation is going to be Rafah. And where do people go? Does Israel say go south? There's no south anymore. This is the border between Gaza and Egypt. Where do people go? Into the sea? No, I don't know. I mean, I literally don't know. You heard at the beginning of this operation a lot of Palestinians, and I understand why, because of good historical reasons that would be thoroughly internalized in every Palestinian individual. You don't leave because look what happened. Look what happened in 48. But when you starve people, when you deny them water, when you deny them medicines, when you deny them proper sanitation, when they have no choice, and you push, you open that border, it wouldn't surprise me if tens and hundreds of thousands of people flooded over. And I think that's clearly one of the options that Israel is working towards. The other options I just think are too horrific to imagine, and that's just mass deaths from disease. Does America act under those circumstances? I don't know. I mean, I literally don't know. You would have thought that the political pressure would become too much, and not just because of Michigan, but because of what will go on, I would hope and I believe, what will go on in Cairo, Alexandria, Amman, Beirut, you name it, the Arab Street, what's going on, what would go on in Saudi Arabia, that just the pressure from the Arab masses, as well as demonstrations in London, Berlin, Paris, wherever, New York, Washington. One would hope that that would be the case, but who knows? Who knows? So this is why we've warned in our CPGB thesis that at least militarily, that seems to be what Israel is aiming at, pushing people over the border. But as I said, maybe Israel is content to see people die of disease on a mass scale, and just says nothing to do with us. Well, it is to do with them. And if you stand by and deny people food, deny people medicine, deny people proper sanitation, when you are when you have the power, then you are complicit. And indeed, that's what the ICJ has ruled, that there is a danger of that. And Israeli ministers, Israeli generals, Israeli privates can therefore make themselves vulnerable to charges of being complicit in genocide, which would also make, as I understand it, those that are facilitating that complicit in genocide, and therefore Keir Starmer, Rishi Sunak, Joe Biden, etc., etc., etc. Okay, just wanted now to move things. What's the time? 43, so I need to be coming to a close. Thought it was worthwhile taking up Comrade Steve Freeman in the Weekly Workers' Letters column this week. Thank you. I know you're not here at the moment, Steve, but thanks for the contribution. It's useful. I like debate. We in the CPGB like debate, and I hope it provokes letters in the Weekly Worker this week. Basically, the comrade argues that there's only two alternatives to what's going on at the present time in Israel, Palestine, and that's either a two-state solution, which he rightly dismisses as delusional. This is something that's pushed, by the United States. I think completely hypocritical. Like it, two states. How many decades have we heard that from the United States? But nothing, nothing, nothing has happened. Yes, we've got a Bantustan on the West Bank. We've got this open prison, this reservation. That's called Gaza. But the two state being pushed by the United States, British government, EU. No, yes, you're right, Steve. It's delusional. It's a cruel trick. Should also be added, though, that it's not only pushed by the United States, it's also pushed by official communism, and it's also pushed by various forces within Palestine, including the official Communist Party. So, not quite just international imperialism, but the point nonetheless is made. And the only other alternative that the comrade says is a one-state solution. And what he specifically says is a federal Republic of Israel and Palestine. And he describes the present-day Israel as a 2080 nation. I am getting my terms right. I'm choosing my terms correctly and accurately. This is profoundly wrong. It's true that as a state, Israel contains a 20% Arab minority who have second-class rights and all the rest of it. Has an 80% Jewish Hebrew majority. That's correct. But what you have is two nations. Two nations. And the Arabs in Israel are of the same nation as those on the West Bank and Gaza. They're not separate. They speak the same language, they have the same culture, they have the same sense of identity. And of course, also what we have in terms of Palestine is a wider Arabic identity, not only because of language, but also because of history. And I've already spoken, about Cairo, Alexandria, Amman. If you look at the history of Palestine, Hamas has its origins in the Muslim Brotherhood that was born in Egypt. If we look at Palestine, it was part of the Ottoman province, or it was part of the Ottoman Syria that was divided up after the defeat of the Ottoman Empire in World War I along nice, neat colonial lines by the British and the French. And there is still that identity. After all, if we look at the West Bank, that was part of Jordan in my lifetime. So there is a wider identity, but there isn't one Israeli nation. There's a national question. And precisely, what I would argue is, well, there are many different possibilities. There is a one state possibility, but I just ask myself, how's that going to be brought about? Comrade Steve says, well, it requires international solidarity. And I go, okay, so I'll be on the streets of London and I'll see you there, Steve. Okay. Meanwhile, what you have is a working class in Israel that gains national privileges from its position as being part of the oppressor nation, not only in Israel, but in Israel, Palestine. It gains special privileges because Israel is the US attack dog in the whole of the Middle East. The United States subsidizes Israel because it's their unsinkable aircraft carrier, because the population, the Israeli Jewish population, is loyal to the alliance with the United States. And what you get is a class dynamic under those circumstances you can observe in other colonial situations, but specifically in Israel, of where those below in the Israeli working class are not to be found on the left, but are to be found on the right. They are going to be the least sympathetic to the rights of the Palestinians. They are the ones that are going to be in competition with worse paid either foreign or Palestinian labor. They are the ones that are going to be voting for the far right parties. That's the politics. That's the dynamic. So Comrade Steve says, well, we in the CPGB are saying that the Israeli working class should sit it out. We've got no minimum program until it's a socialist revolution. That's just not true. We call for the withdrawal of Israeli forces to pre-67 borders, not as a final solution, but that's the call we would. We'd make the call for the decolonization of the West Bank. We would make the call for the end of the siege of Gaza, let alone the end of the bombing, let alone for the end of the ethnic cleansing in Gaza. In Israel itself, what would we call for? We would call for the end of the privileges given to the Orthodox wing of Judaism, the discrimination that liberal and secular Jews undergo. So, for example, as I understand it, tell me if I'm wrong, I'm an atheist. How do I get married in Israel? Citizenship rights, all these things. Of course, we're going to have demands around, the fact that anyone who, I don't know, what is it, a quarter? You have to have a mother, grandmother, grandfather who was Jewish to freely move to Israel. What about Palestinians having that right? That is something you'd raise as part of the minimum program. But minimum programs are not utopian. And Steve Freeman, seems to regard them. He's saying we're verging on anti-Semitism because we don't give the Israeli working class the right to a minimum program. Well, it's not up to us to grant anything. What we're out to do is map out a strategy for global socialism. That's what it's about. And it Steve Freeman reminds me of when I was in the Socialist Alliance and we published the Weekly Worker. And we did one week. We published a Weekly Worker with a back page by a certain comrade who's now back in Australia calling for the end of the Federal Republic. Not Federal Republic, the Federation of Australia, Federation, not Republic, but a republic. We called for, and you know, we were along with Engels, we were questioning state rights. And we also published, I think, an article calling for a federal republic in Britain, between Scotland and Wales. And we called for a unified Ireland. And some bright spark got up and said, look, they've got a different line in each country. And well, that's precisely the point, because each country is different. And the idea that you go and you've already worked out your blueprint is truly stupid. I think Tony Clift made the joke, didn't he, about navigating, the modern post-World War I using the transitional program. He said was the equivalent of navigating the Paris Metro with a map of the London Underground. Well, the map of the London Underground is pretty useful when it comes to London, but don't transfer the Paris Metro onto London. You'll get lost. And that's the point of it. So, of course, you need a specific program. And our strategy is precisely based on the idea that the only way we can gain a democratic, civilized solution here is to win the consent of the Israeli masses, which means offering them something. And it means offering them precisely the chance to be part of the ruling class, as opposed to losing their national privileges, which would be inevitable under a one-state capitalist solution. And of course, for us, the minimum program and the maximum program are not separated, by some sea, some, Atlantic Ocean, some Berlin Wall or something along those lines. Inevitably, if you look at our minimum program, we are well aware that many aspects of the minimum program can only be realized with the rule of the working class, with a working class government. We don't know that. What we put forward in terms of the minimum program is demands that are realizable under capitalism. And that's why precisely we put forward our regional strategy when it comes to Israel Palestine. It has to be seen as part of the Middle East. Another possibility that Steve Freeman hasn't considered, not that we would include it in our program, of course, you're no doubt right, and that's the possibility of a Muslim Brotherhood regime in Egypt that really comes to power, that takes over the army. That's a possibility. There's all sorts of other solutions. But so we're putting forward, from our point of view, the most civilized solution, the one that provides the shortest distance to socialism. Because unlike Steve Freeman, we haven't given up on socialism. We haven't given up on communism. And indeed, when I look at the world today, not least when it comes to the climate crisis, how on earth is anyone seriously envisaging you can overcome the climate crisis and maintain capitalism? I don't think it's possible. I think even if capitalism remains in power, sort of, you've got to overcome capitalism. You've got to have something equivalent to, Kriegs Socialismus. The profit motive has to be overcome, even if it's by sections of the capitalist state. So you end up with some sort of freaky society, but you cannot overcome the climate crisis with capitalism. And I can say that. And it doesn't mean I've given up on minimum demands when it comes to the climate question. So we need the minimum program, yes, to train the working class, but we also need the maximum program to make sense of the minimum program. We are communists. We're not radical Democrats. We're radical Democrats plus. That needs to be understood. Anyway, finally, in my last 4 minutes, try to be brief. We do have history being made over the other side of the water in Belfast, in Stormont. Here, after all, after the end of the Irish Revolution, okay, cut short, we all know that. We had the creation by the British imperial authorities in conjunction with the allies in the north-ish of Ireland. I'll call it Ulster for the sake of, I'll call it Ulster for the sake of brevity, but making the point that, of course, what was involved wasn't Ulster, but was six counties of the province of Ulster. And indeed, what happened in the creation of Northern Ireland wasn't just the dividing up of counties, was instead of getting the straight lines that we saw in the Middle East, we got the most higgledy-piggledy lines to ensure the maximum territory and the maximum population that was Protestant in what is called Northern Ireland. Why call it Northern Ireland in inverted commas? Because actually the northern part of the south is actually more north than the north of Ireland, if you see the point. Anyway, that one aside, here was going to be a Protestant state for a Protestant people. And the geography seemed pretty damn secure because it was not a, a 2080 state. I don't know about the origins, but in my lifetime, it was a two-thirds third state. Well, now we have, roughly speaking, I don't know what the latest census will reveal, but roughly speaking, a 50-50 state. And of course, what we have in Northern Ireland's jolly good PR system is Sinn Féin, amazingly, for the drafters of the Good Friday deal, being the biggest party, and amazingly for the drafters of the Good Friday deal, the DUP, Ian Paisley's Mr. No's party, being the second party. Okay, so what we have, I'll be very brief here. We're having an article in this week's paper, but what we have from Sinn Féin is the idea that because of this, and it is history, Sinn Féin, Sinn Féin IRA, good God, not just a, they call them nationalists, by the way, now in BBC. They're no longer Republicans. I just noticed the name change. What? Used to be the SDLP that were the nationalists, and then we had the Republicans. So Sinn Féin are now nationalists. I don't know what the difference is. Either way, what we have is Michelle O'Neill and other Sinn Féiners saying that a united Ireland is now in their grasp. I'm very, very skeptical. So, yes, history has been made. We have a Sinn Féin First Minister. Okay, we have a deputy who's DUP. And it does seem, that there you are. What's it going to take? Well, it used to be maybe a few weeks ago, maybe a few months ago, that that sort of made sense. I'm not going to push it because I don't think it does. But if you look back at opinion polls in the South in October, Sinn Féin was running way ahead of the two mainstream constitutional Republicans. I don't know what the right name is. Either way, the parties that come from the original Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. Sinn Féin had 32% of the projected vote. Well, since then, into November, that went down to 29%. This last month, it went down to 25%. Now, I've only done some reading in the mainstream bourgeois press, and I'm told it's the migration question. I don't know, but clearly that's an important question. I don't know who's benefited from the decline of of Sinn Féin. It's not people before profit. They're on 3%. That was my reading of the last poll. But what it makes is at least the possibility of a Sinn Féin government. Add this, add that, add bloody everything else. But what needs to be understood, in my view, about Irish unity, it's not up to the First Minister in Stormont. It's not up to the Prime Minister in Dublin. getting together and saying, look, we're both Sinn Féin, we both want Irish unity, let's get together and see to it. What we have is a Good Friday deal that says that for there to be a border poll, there has to be agreement with Westminster, let alone others, right? And all I would argue is look at Scotland. Look how long Scotland has had at least half the population in terms of polls wanting independence. Look how long they've had a SNP government. Look at it now. Look at the possibility of dirty tricks. I don't see it. The idea that British imperialism would withdraw from Northern Ireland in the same way that it withdrew from Basra after the Iraq War, or Aden, or Egypt, I think is delusional. Northern Ireland is part of the UK state. It's an integral part of the UK state. It's also part of British imperialism's strategic geography. Now, all states have a habit of invading neighbours in order to protect themselves. We're threatened by our next door neighbour, so in order to protect ourselves, we invade them. Big powerful states have been doing that a long time, and not just the British state, but the English feudal state grew in part because of land hunger of the aristocracy, but also because of strategic considerations, and that carried on into modern times. So, in other words, if you looked at the soft underbelly of the Hanoverian regime, it lay in Ireland or in Scotland, right? If you look at it in modern times, the underbelly was German support for Irish nationalism. Well, of course, there's no longer, the German Reich. There's no longer Hitler. But the idea that British imperialism would say everything's now hunky-dory with Europe, I don't think is a serious argument. In other words, it's not just going to be the politicians, it's going to be the generals that are saying no to any proposed Irish unity. And they will be conspiring to put in place barriers. And that needs to be understood. So, yes, in terms of the possibility of Irish unity, it clearly has increased, but we need to understand that we're not on the edge of anything. And as I said, there were only a short time ago that thought that it was automatic that Scotland, within a couple of years, would be independent. All it would take is a Nicola Sturgeon illegal referendum or persuading the government in Westminster to have a legal referendum, and it would all be over, other than, divvying out the national debt and the army. I don't think so. I think the British government will fight tooth and claw when it comes to preventing Irish unity, in the same way that it will fight tooth and claw to prevent the breakup of Britain, Great Britain.